I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Asher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where we buy stuff we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like.
Hey, this is Crazy Town producer Melody Allison. Thanks for listening. Here in Season 6, we're exploring escape routes, pathways that just might get us out of Crazy Town. In today's episode, Jason, Rob, and Asher are escaping consumerism. And here's a quick warning. Sometimes this podcast uses swear words.
Language!
If you like what you're hearing, please let some friends know about Crazy Town. Now, on to the show.
Hey, so sometimes I like to think of Crazy Town as a bit of therapy. So yeah. I would like to share a traumatic story of my past with you two to open this episode.
You're going to do your Freud kind of
amen, whatever.
Deep listening. That's not how Freud spoke.
Oh, okay.
Tell me about your mother.
It's not.
I said a Latino.
It's not.
That was pathetic.
This therapy session is off the rails already.
So, Rob, I want you to know, it's not what's wrong with you. It's what happened to you.
Okay, thank you.
Tell me.
Okay, so when I was a 17-year-old about to embark on my college career, I needed to get some money to help pay for said college. So I really was a fan of Northlake Mall, which was near my house.
Yeah, I had Valco Fashion Mall as my stomping house.
Wow, Valco Fashion, that's a good one. But a newer, better strip mall opened up across the street from Northlake Mall. It was called Northlake Tower Festival.
You know, there must have been a deep story between the owners of those two. Like, to open it directly across the street is like a big fuck you, don't
you
think?
I know. It's rough. Well,
somebody pissed somebody else off earlier.
The anchor store at Northlake Tower Festival was Toys R Us.
Sweet. That was the anchor store.
And, you know, as a 17-year-old, I like playing with toys.
No, you must have outgrown it by then. It must have been horrible.
Have you met Rob?
Yeah. I was always a little behind the curve. All right. Okay. It
took him until he was 29 to get over that.
Right. I still could get a good Star Wars scenario going with my action figures.
Sure.
So, you guys know Toys R Us. Let me just play for you the ubiquitous at that time theme song.
You don't need to play it for us.
I don't actually heard. I don't remember it.
I'm going to play
it. You'll remember it as soon as you hear it.
Here, listen to this.
From bikes to trains to video games, it's the biggest toy store there is.
Gee whiz!
I don't want to grow up, because maybe if I did, I couldn't be a Toys R Us kid.
Okay,
so. Doesn't ring a bell. That? Doesn't ring a bell.
I don't want to grow up.
That's a shitty jingle. I can't remember it.
You don't recognize that?
No.
I think there's something wrong with you.
That's incredible. I'm amazed.
Yeah. Well, so I had to listen to that song on repeat all day long, every day.
Wait, they would play it in the store?
They'd play that in the store. God. They would play Carly Simon tunes.
And my mirror neurons are in pain right now.
So one of the things about the Toys R Us, the sheer length, height, width of the store was incredible. The colors, like the pink Barbie aisle.
Yeah.
It was just like kind of a explosion of your senses.
Yeah.
And the thing about it that was really good, like I said, I want to get money for college. I made $4 an hour.
That's Oh my God, you were just rolling in it.
Yeah.
And
$4 an hour.
What I remember about that that summer
they were paying kid salaries.
Yeah, that's right.
I made an allowance.
Well, so this is the thing. I remember just wanting out the whole summer. Like, I didn't want to be there. My favorite parts of the day were when I could hide out in the warehouse and just stock diapers or whatever. You know, I wouldn't have to be out on that floor.
Yeah.
Closing time
was
awesome.
They were selling diapers?
Oh, yeah. Diapers and baby formula were huge there.
Gotta run to the Toys R Us to get myself some diapers.
They were toy diapers.
Right. For little stuffed animals. And stuff.
Barbie diapers and stuff. And like
those are really small.
Cabbage Patch Kids. I remember
those. They had diapers.
Okay. Well, closing time was also a favorite, despite the mess the store was. Imagine how messy a Toys R Us gets.
Yeah, because kids are taking stuff out and then just dropping on the floor.
One of my favorite things to do there was send people elsewhere. So I remember one time they used to sell Huffy bikes, and this guy came in. He's like, "Hey, I was thinking about getting a bike for my daughter. What do you recommend?" And I was like, "I recommend you go to the bike store."
Right, because his bike will break.
I was also just a 17-year-old ass.
Yeah, I guess you weren't getting paid on commission.
Yeah. Well, and then of course, Toys R Us went bankrupt in 2018. And there's a guy named...
Probably couldn't pay its medical bills.
A day that will live out right. me.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Chase Holfelder who recorded kind of a remake of the Toys R Us song okay. that I want to play for you guys.
Okay.
Check this one out.
That's actually good. So I like that.
So
I like that.
Yeah, he turned it into a dirge, right?
It's
like the death of yeah. Toys R Us.
It's good.
It's really incredible.
Yeah.
Well, that jingle will live on in our brains until we die.
Well, you know, despite this soft spot I got in my heart for Legos and Star Wars action figures mm. and vintage video games and yeah. stuff like that, the Toys R Us megastore was a really good example of, our topic today, over-the-top consumerism, where you're enticed to buy a bunch of plastic crap that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not even talk about the advertising that comes along with that, at least not yet.
Yeah.
Do you think that you became less of a consumerist fuckface after working there?
Probably. Yeah. I think... The reason I'm in therapy with you guys right now is like
directly
yeah,
that
trying
experience.
To shake that stuff yeah. off, right?
I think that.
Well, I'm grateful.
Yeah, and
I'm grateful to your summer at Toys R Us.
So I think we should traumatize our audience now, with
as we do,
yeah,
as we
do. With giving them the Crazy Town kind of statistics related to consumerism.
Do we tell people that we're actually being underwritten by the American Therapy Association?
and we're sponsored by Toys R Us.
Right,
by yeah. a bankrupt Toys R Us.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're paying us in old toys.
Right. Yeah. yeah. Anyway, okay. So in 2019, U.S. per capita total material consumption, and this is including fuels, and this is an important thing, was 23.75, let's just round it up to 24 metric tons per person. That's a per capita.
24 metric tons. Okay.
Yeah. So in 2019, I used 24 metric tons of crap.
Yeah, per year. Yeah. And that includes fuels. And more than half of that is actually oil, coal, natural gas, stuff we just combust. Right.
Oh, so that's good. Only half of it was Barbies and Star Wars.
So that's
action
like a
things.
Dozen cars in weight or something.
Pretty freaking gigantic, right? Yeah. This is 88% higher than in Europe, right? Which has comparable, if not better,
losers.
Now, what's interesting for me to think about is that in the last 100 years or so, the use of renewable materials, what is considered like regrowable, like wood, other natural fibers,
yeah.
that has decreased dramatically. It went from 41% of the total materials by weight to 5%. So 95% of what we now are quote unquote consuming is non-renewable materials.
Great.
Right. Yeah. I mean, 41% wasn't that great. And that's because there's minerals like, you know, rock and sand, these things that don't regrow. Like you mine this stuff out.
Yeah.
It was still like 60% of the US economy 100 years ago. Now, what's interesting to think about it is you talk about the plastics in the toy store and stuff, but currently, about 80% of the non-fuel consumption of materials goes towards construction.
Wow.
It's like the freeways expanding, the malls that the Toys R Us
goes
in. All
the houses of suburban sprawl. Yeah.
And also, houses are getting bigger. So, in 1920 to 2014, the average floor area in a U.S. home increased from a little over 1,000 square feet to almost 2,700 square feet.
Well, that's progress, right?
Yeah.
Wait a second. Yeah. I'm feeling like bad about myself now because so when I moved from California here, I had a 1,200 square foot house in California and
yeah.
I doubled the size
you
of my house,
the size,
which
yeah.
was insane.
Yeah.
You're just trying to keep up with the times.
No, we're not even keeping up. That's still
you're still smaller.
Below.
You're still smaller than average of the current new home. But here's what's interesting. You have four people in your home.
Yes.
So the average U.S.
And
home.
A dog.
Yeah, and a dog. The average U.S. home actually now has 2.5 people.
Oh, sweet.
Well, but you're behind.
Oh,
because,
so if we actually think about it per person.
Yeah, you're behind.
Square foot, we're way behind.
But if you do the math, like there was more people living per home in 1920 than there is today, right?
Yeah.
So actually, per capita today, everyone has the equivalent of what a family of four had together in 1920.
Again, thank you for reporting statistics of progress.
Yes.
I want to take you guys to sort of a culmination of consumerist culture. You know, you're talking about the houses getting bigger.
Yeah.
And of course, with a bigger house, you got to fill it with more stuff, I guess. But it starts overflowing. Yeah. So what do you do?
It's hard to get the balance right.
Well, you know, this is why America is so ingenious. You go rent a self-storage unit where you can keep your excess stuff. So I got a bunch of stats on self-storage. So we're going to play two truths and a lie. I'm going to read you three statistics, one of which I made up.
Good.
And you guys try to, you know, try to suss out what it is.
Okay.
Okay. Here's one. We've got greater than 1.8 billion square feet of self-storage space in the U.S. That's approximately the size of Washington, D.C. Okay, there's one stat for you. No calculating. This is all intuition. Jason's reaching for a calculator.
Okay, I'm just doing the per capita. Yeah. That seems reasonable.
Do it in your head. Come on.
I did.
Okay. Stat number two, public storage, which is the very generic name of the largest self-storage company in the United States. You can get that under New York Stock Exchange abbreviation PSA.
Buying some.
Yeah. So this company, Public Storage, was the fastest growing company in the United States during the aughts. So from 2000 to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's your third stat. There are 50,000 self-storage facilities in the U.S., a number that is more than the combined total of Subway, Starbucks, and Walgreens outlets.
Whoa. My gosh.
Whoa.
Those are your three stats.
And we're supposed to figure out which one's wrong?
One is false.
So let me first commend you, because you did a pretty good job coming up with, I mean, they're all insane, right?
They're all insane, and I couldn't believe any of them. This is a problem for me.
See, I'm smart, so I have a theory here.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But no, you go first, Jason.
I'm going to say the 50,000 one is that number is too round, and it's just, you know, Subway, Starbucks, Walgreens, too convenient.
Wow.
That's bullshit. I'm calling you on that part.
I hate my voice when you're mimicking it. It's terrible.
I am going to say it's the second one, and here's why. Because you said the aughts.
Yeah.
That was a period of great growth for a lot of companies. So it's not because maybe public storage wasn't growing a lot, but you know.
A lot of stuff was growing.
I mean, isn't that when Facebook came online? Even Starbucks, I bet, was growing faster. There was this great Onion headline, which was, Starbucks' next growth strategy is opening Starbucks in their own bathrooms.
Right.
I mean, they were growing like mad.
There's like pictures of Starbucks kitty corner each other on the same block. I mean, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah. So I'm going to say it's the second one is not.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I'm going to tell you, and I hate this because, Asher, you premised all that with saying, I'm smart.
and it turns out
you are.
Oh.
So we've just for once in his life, we've corroborated his intelligence.
Dunning-Kruger's got nothing on me.
Yeah. I kind of thought that could have been a giveaway because, that's when the tech boom really was taken off too. So, well, can we just look at the public storage, the self-storage as being emblematic of this acceleration in consumerism?
Sure. Let's pick an emblem.
Here's a real stat again. In 1984, there were 6,600 self-storage facilities in the U.S., and now there's 50,000 of them. I mean,
that's progress. Something I read was that 65% of the people who have self-storage also have a garage.
Of course.
So it's not like...
Yeah, the walk-up apartment in New York City.
Exactly. It's not like, I downsize, I have a small space, so I need to have
storage. I live on my boat.
Whatever. Exactly. It's not those people. It's 65% have a fucking garage.
Probably a three-car garage.
Right, exactly.
Hey, the garage is sacred space for the car.
Right, of course. We shouldn't even consider it as something that
you know, you can store a lot of stuff in your car, too.
You talked about self-storage as being kind of emblematic. I think that what's happened with fashion and the acceleration of what people are calling fast fashion is actually really telling in terms of what's been happening with consumerism. Because, you know, the truth is, and we've talked about this before, consumerism became the sort of staple of the American economy and the global economy decades and decades and decades ago. It was sort of born out of industrialization and overproduction of stuff. And they started advertising and loans and all the things that they did to kind of make it possible for people to buy shit, right? So we've been on that path for a while. But there's an acceleration that's happening.
Yeah.
And fashion is really interesting. So here's my turn to do stats.
Okay? There you go. We each get a turn.
In 2015, according to True Cost, the world consumes around 80 billion new pieces of clothing every year.
That's like 10 per person worldwide.
Yeah, a little bit more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's 400% more than 20 years ago.
Wow. I'm just sighing internally, externally. Yeah. This is not helping my therapy session, okay?
It's going to get worse. You and your stats. Are you ready?
It always gets worse.
People are now buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long as they used to, okay?
Yeah, I take mine off by noon every day.
Exactly. Yeah, when we're not just talking about, you know, superstar singers changing their outfits on stage.
Yeah.
30% of all the clothes made globally are never actually worn.
Oh, that's bad.
What are we doing with them?
I don't know.
There must be in self-storage units.
No, they probably don't sell. Actually, this is a good question. How many of them were sold and never worn versus just never sold, right?
Yeah.
Good question. And then let's just talk about some of the environmental impacts, right?
Yeah, because why not? Let's get really depressed here.
Textile waste is the fastest growing part of the waste stream of the United
States. And that's why we're highlighting it.
This is so fantastic.
Yeah.
You know when you're paddling down the river in a canoe and it's just shirts and pants and you can barely get the canoe through all of that? It's the worst.
Sadly, in some places in the world, it's kind of like that. In the U.S., 80% of used clothing is either sent to the landfill or incinerated. So people think when they donate clothing or they return clothing, whatever, it goes to another home that's in need, you know, whether it's in the U.S. or somewhere else. But 80% of it
is. Because most of it is probably pretty crappy.
Let's talk about some of the social implications, kind of the injustice of it. So who would you think is the richest man in the world? Who comes to mind when you think?
Well,
I think Bezos.
In our false prophets, we had the Elon Musk episode about Elon Musk, brought to you by Elon Musk. I would guess him.
Well, not anymore. He's been canceled so much because of his outlandish behavior.
Well,
so.
he's still number two. So according to Forbes,
he's still number
Elon
two.
Is number two.
Wow,
Bezos is up there. The wealthiest person in the world is Bernard Arnault. Frenchman made all his wealth in fashion and luxury goods. He's worth about $180 billion.
Wow.
Sweet.
The fashion industry is actually one of the largest employers in the entire world globally. Yeah. Something like 75 million people are employed by it. According to the nonprofit Remake, 80% of apparel is made by young women, so ages 18 to 24 around the world. Mm-hmm. Often working in dangerous working conditions, getting paid for very low pay. So, you know, the contrast between Arnault and the reality for many, many primarily young women around the world producing these things that people don't wear.
Well, the thing is, you know, when you think about fashion, you often think about something that is, you know, stylish or, you know, some designer has gone through and but a lot of it's just complete junk. Like, you know, what's driving me crazy, I've noticed, is that all the sports teams now have a new uniform, a new hat for almost everything, every season.
Oh, right. Like it's Mother's Day. You got to wear pink.
Exactly. Right? Or damn cancer or military appreciation.
All the things that nobody really should give a shit about.
It's just driving me crazy.
If you're going to buy a souvenir shirt, you got to get the one with the athlete's name on the back. And, you know, you got to get a new one the next year with the new athlete.
Yeah, because they keep getting rid of the athletes. Well, and that's something else about fashion, which is that it's become so connected with individuals and celebrities, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if it started with Michael Jordan and Nike, you know, but that didn't used to necessarily be the case. I mean, fashion was set, you know, in different ways. And that's why, you know, we think of things being fashionable, right? It's like it goes through these cycles or these periods or whatever, and it's influenced by people, usually the wealthy, right? Yeah. Or whatever. But we've attached it so much to like individual personas. Yeah. And for celebrities, athletes, a lot of the money that they make actually comes from
endorsements,
you know, endorsements or having their own product lines that they have.
Yeah, the smart ones do that. The Jordans and the LeBrons, they run their own
consumers. They start their own businesses.
I think the sports jerseys is a good example of how people out here can get drawn into it. You know, it's like, oh, I got to get the new jersey. And, you know, and I'm even guilty. Like, I bought my daughter the special Rose City jersey version of the Portland Timbers because it was a cool new one. So
It's okay to buy something every once in a while, Rob.
Well, I did incinerate it immediately because that's what our culture
says. You had her wear
it
once, right? Yeah, here we are talking about the stuff that we've collected, just consumerism run wild. And you played some clips for us earlier, Rob. When I think about stuff, The first thing that comes to mind is the George Carlin bit, A Place for My Stuff.
Absolute guys, classic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is worth watching, but I'm just going to play a little bit, you know, that he did from one of his shows.
You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much goddamn stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off in an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you got to lock it up. Wouldn't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that kind of sums it up right there.
Well, I mean, to me, it's hilarious. He's almost just stating facts, and it's so funny.
Right.
I love, my favorite part of the thing is, have you noticed that their stuff is shit and your shit is stuff? Right. I love that part.
Right. Yeah, you know, sometimes you go to these like yard sales, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe the crap these people have. But then, of course, you probably have half the same
stuff. Right, and then you buy it and bring it home.
But yours is not crap.
Now I have the crap.
That's right.
Well, you know, there is some awesome stuff out there that you do need to sock away in your house. And here's the one I found is called Hander Pants.
What?
Okay. And it's underpants for your hands.
What do you mean? Aren't they called gloves?
Well, exactly. So it's like a fingerless glove that looks like whitey tighties covering your hands. And
not a bad idea.
The whitey tighty version you can buy for $14.50.
Hmm. What are you supposed to do with it?
Well, that's the funny thing. It says on their ad, it's stylish for any occasion. Hundreds of uses. Wonderful gift.
It's like you have your hanky on your hand ready to
exactly.
go.
Exactly. Like, all I can think is the nasty stuff that you wipe on it.
But here's the thing.
And it's white.
Yeah. But it's $3 more for the chic black hander pants.
Good great pants. Name.
You know somebody hander just, pants. The whole thing came out of coming up with that name when they're drunk one night.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's completely like a backwards way of coming up with the product.
And that's 90% of their customers are ordering when they're exactly, drunk. When they're drunk. I got to have some hander pants. This is a message to all you crazy townies out there. Sometimes Jason, Asher, and I wish you could be here in the room with us when we're riffing on eco-modernist nightmares, the end of capitalism, the collapse of civilization, and lines from Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Since you can't be here, maybe we could still be in contact in another way. If you've got a comment about the show, or you want to throw some shade at us, or you got a question...
Or you have a suggestion of escape route stuff.
Yeah, right? Maybe you got a story of your own you want to share... Go over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave us a review and write your comment there. In your comment, include your idea, whatever it is, and we'll think about sharing it in an episode.
How's this? I'll be back. Is that any good?
Oh my God, that's terrible.
You try it. You try it.
Get to the chopper! Okay, another listener comment we've got this episode comes in from a fellow named James. His subject is the future of rural space. So, you know,
what
Jason,
the hell is
ready.
He talking space? About?
I think rural areas.
We were both thinking about
on the same way.
Growing potatoes in space.
Are there Starlink satellites in rural space? Okay, so James says... In case you are unaware, I'm watching the World Bank presentation, The Future of Rural Space, on YouTube. Huh. Their take could not be more different from your own.
Hmm.
Now, what strikes me is that's a huge surprise that we are not perfectly aligned with the World Bank.
I can't believe they haven't been listening to us. This is ridiculous. We gotta email them.
Let me guess, the future of rural space in their view is there is no future for rural space.
Right. It's developed that sucker. We need cities on that rural
space. Get rid of it. That's an abomination.
Well, I thank you for the tip. I'm going to look it up and I'm going to write him an angry letter.
Yeah. Thanks, James. So here we are at the Marvin Harris Memorial Lens of Doom as it applies to consumerism. And the quick reminder, Marvin Harris was a anthropologist, sociologist type who had a little theory called cultural materialism, in which he said the infrastructure, the surroundings, play a huge role in determining the structure or the rules and policies that bind society together, which in turn plays a huge role in shaping the superstructure or the culture and belief systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the infrastructure of consumerism.
Okay.
There's a lot to it. I mean, we've already talked about advertising.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of stuff that you see in the real world, like shopping malls and these big houses where yep. George Carlin has to put all of his stuff.
The whole yeah. built environment. Yeah.
Yeah. The mega stores or big box stores. We've talked in the past about cargo ships and the containers, the standardized containers that can yep. go off the ship and onto rail and truck and that yeah, amazing
all the highways, the highway systems.
That's
you know,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to rail. An episode of a podcast that's put out by The Atlantic recently, and they were looking at barcodes, you know, the UPC symbols on every product. And that was a huge thing
right.
for standardizing the checkout line, but also inventories mm-hmm. and making all that stuff more efficient.
Yeah. Have you guys been to a store recently where like the barcode didn't work and they
right.
had to punch in like the 18 digit number? God.
But think of the sorry employee that used to have to like yeah. put a price sticker on every like, single product.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's other stuff too, like Amazon and related businesses, the delivery trucks and delivery services, the computer networks that are behind all of this, like PayPal and mm-hmm. and software services. I mean, huge. And it's like the infrastructure of life.
You're right? just scratching the surface, I'm sure.
Well, and there's the thing about all the supply chains of these things, right? So
yeah.
when we talk about fashion, for example, you know, there's the global international commodity market mm-hmm. for things like cotton and
oh. Yeah,
which is a whole shit show.
I've been to cotton fields in Arizona. It's just incredible.
Well, yeah. and I've seen the movie Trading Places, where they are trading orange juice futures on
yeah.
the commodity exchange. So that's my
that
education.
Was high stakes trading.
Yeah,
I think the other thing that's important about fashion is that you know, since we waste so much of it,
yeah,
right. It doesn't build up in our homes. It doesn't build. It goes away. It goes somewhere. And my favorite example of that was when I would travel, there would be these stores called USA stores in different countries. And you walk in and it's like reams of like compressed blocks of t-shirts from the United States.
They were almost generating a fusion reaction.
Yes, it was so dense. And I you know, every once in a while you'll see like some documentary where they're in some country like Guinea-Bissau in Africa or whatever. And someone's wearing like the Super Bowl loser winner shirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, so they printed up all these
the
t-shirts.
The team that didn't win.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. So in some part of the world, you're saying in Guinea-Bissau, my Atlanta Falcons actually held on to their lead against the New England Patriots.
And there's a whole village celebrating that.
They're just wearing that t-shirt.
Yeah. They walking around thinking the Atlanta Falcons are the best team
right.
in football.
Right.
Now, I don't
Whereas
actually
we know the truth.
Yeah. Right.
And I don't actually know if that's a real example, but stuff like that is what I'm getting at. Yes.
Sure. I remember traveling in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union, and American jeans were like,
uh-huh.
so hot, you know, like getting right. Levi's was incredible.
Right. Yeah.
yeah. Well, so we're talking about infrastructure. Here's a weird one for you. What about dopamine? Like I was thinking about dopamine as being something that's really part of all this, because a lot of this consumerist culture or the habits of consumerism, you know, buying stuff,
yeah,
you know, is really fed by the dopamine rush that people get when they go buy something at a store or they get a package, you know, delivered to their home and they're opening up, you know, you're talking about those unboxing
videos. I just watch unboxing videos yeah. and I get dopamine.
Exactly. Yeah.
right.
That's recycled dopamine is what that is.
This is not one of our escape routes. No. Go watch unboxing movies to short circuit your dopamine system.
But like, where does dopamine fit? Is it infrastructure? It's not structure. It's not part of like the rules of society. It's not superstructure. So it's got to be infrastructure.
I think it is infrastructure, even though it's inside it's our, in bodies.
Yeah. It's weird. I don't know.
Oh, it's terrible.
I think it plays a big role in all this.
Yeah, addictive. To be honest.
That is pretty wild. Yeah, I like thinking of that, of our... The way we're built is infrastructure.
Our internal infrastructure.
All right. Well, let's turn to structure now, which again, these are the rules of consumerism. And, we could get really exhaustive here, but there's just some things that rose to the surface for me when I was thinking about this. One is the way that in our culture, working a high paying job is it's like a rule. Like you got to do that if you want to be able to afford what you need. I mean, even medical care in the United States, if you want to afford that, you better have a job that's giving you insurance and paying you, because your insurance isn't going to cover it.
Yeah.
There's other rules too, like, hey, have 27 credit cards and buy everything on credit and don't worry about carrying a debt if you don't have the money.
Well, we've talked about this before. Credit was a huge... creating credit and credit cards and the mechanisms of all that totally unlocked the consumer culture. I mean, without that, I think it would have been really difficult.
Go back to season 4, people. There are a lot of the stuff, we're touching upon season 4 material here.
Yeah.
Another one that really came up for me in terms of the kind of policies and rules of consumerism is that marketing has become... It's a major field of study that you apply to every single business. Every business that's out there has teams of marketers to push their stuff. And
Team we have at Post Carbon Institute, incredible.
Well, I mean, we do have communications staff that is incredible, because we have to get our message out there. But, they're not trying to sell you a bunch of plastic crap.
It'd be easier
for
them.
It would be a lot easier.
I know. Yeah. What we're trying to sell is the hardest
Depression.
Stuff.
Depression.
Yeah.
Well, and I even looked at it. I was sort of like, well, what about marketing in the universities? And, the U.S. News and World Report, they do a lot of stuff with ranking colleges, but they also talk about the different majors. And they had this to say about marketing. They said, a marketing major studies the branding and promotion of products and services to the public and how to target specific demographics.
It's like, God, I'd be so proud of my kids if they went into marketing.
It's a field of study.
I can't believe it.
It actually makes a big difference.
Yeah, applied psychology.
Good marketing. Like, you think about Nike and the Just Do It ad. It was incredible. I could go on a rant about universities and marketing, because you're talking about degrees in marketing and how they're describing that. Let me just tell you how much fucking mail my family has received in the last, I don't know how many months, from every university in the entire country, practically. Some of them... 8 to 12 times. I'm not even joking. Constantly just sending us postcards, sending us packets, sending us magazines, emails, basically trying to get my son to apply to their college so that they could decline him, basically.
I still remember one of those from when I was in high school.
Uh-huh.
I got one. It was a pretty gossy thing. It says, "How does Puget sound?"
Oh, that's clever.
Oh,
not good.
That's good marketing.
Good. I know.
Excellent marketing.
Yeah.
I want to go on a little rant about marketing as a verb, to market something. It's like you with your birding.
They talk about marketing as a different, it means a different thing. It means to actually go to market.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here,
here it doesn't.
Yeah. You got to market the shit out of Puget Sound University.
Right. There's another thing that enables this consumerism, and it really applies to some of the stuff we were talking about with fashion, right? Which is sort of return policies and the changes that have happened, I think, with how easy it is to return things. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a real shift with the internet age and e-commerce, where I think a lot of what e-commerce was trying to do was to undercut and compete against retail stores.
Right.
So they're offering, a lot of it was around like free shipping in some cases, but they're also making it really easy to return stuff.
Yeah.
And changing those to make it so easy. And there's actually an infrastructure around that too. Like the infrastructure around that is, you can buy something from Amazon, you know, on your computer, it gets delivered to you, you know, amazingly in your house. You get your dopamine rush and you're like, ah, fuck this, I don't like it. And then you just basically can drop it off at the UPS store or wherever you go, and you don't have to do anything. You literally just drop the, here's the box, and they take care of all of it for you. And with kind of free return policies or exchanges, whatever, you just get the next.
Do you get any dopamine from that drop off procedure?
I don't know if it's the same level of dopamine.
But people are buying extra sizes because they're not sure. And then they send the sizes and fit.
Because you used to go to the store and try it on different sizes. Right. How else do you try? I mean, we've had that in my house. My son, who's growing so much, is like, what's the right shoe size?
Right. Yeah, sure.
You know, for him.
But I think a lot of that gets trashed, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. We've talked about this. Yeah. Most of it goes to the garbage.
Pretty soon we can get rid of the trucks and we can have those old bank vacuum tubes just running to everybody's house, right? So Amazon just puts stuff in the vacuum tube, comes to your house, and you just shove the stuff back.
Well, Amazon has been working on drone deliveries, right? And in some places, like, guaranteeing that you can get stuff within 2 hours.
It's hard because I don't tend to follow these rules. So, like, I wear the same clothes over and over again. I'll often have the same pair of pants, the same, like, sweatshirt, day in and day out. I do change underwear and socks and t-shirts. Thank God.
Yeah, you got a brand new pair of hander pants, right?
Yes, exactly. But other than that, it's like I cycle through the same thing. But, you know, there's this whole stigma against wearing the same, like, fancy clothes out to events when people would go out to, like, events and you had to get a different dress or whatever.
I think it's more for women than men, to be honest.
Yeah.
A man can wear the same tux.
I can wear the same suit over and over. No one's going to care. All right. Yeah. So.
Well, I think that's getting into the idea of superstructure and the culture around this. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe segue there. And I got to say that it is pervasive in American culture to think, if I can just own that one thing, that thing over there, I'm going to be happy. Like, that is, I feel like that's programmed and an underlying current in the whole setup.
Yeah.
And I want to be immune to it, but sometimes I find I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, I can get pretty obsessive about, especially cycling stuff, you know, like gotta have a really nice bike, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I think the other thing, and I don't fall prey to this one that much, but it's sort of like, your stuff defines who you are,
right?
You know, rather than your values, rather than what you're bringing to the world, it's the load of crap that you have on you and with you and what you're wearing.
I think we're all susceptible to that stuff, you know? Yeah. Like, we have attachments to brands. I remember learning about how, I think was it Ford was the first company that started offering different paint colors for their cars, you know?
I don't know. And I thought Ford was the, you can have it any color you want as long as it's black.
Right. Well, I don't remember which company it was, but that was an innovation that they had. And that was part of it, was being able to sort of say, like, this represents my identity. Do you know what I mean? I know some people are like, I only get a car this color. It's not even like the brand necessarily. Do you know what I mean? But attaching your identity to an object or a consumer product, I think we're all susceptible to it. Mm-hmm. My favorite time of year is Christmas.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
That's and then Black Friday. And I'm so glad that they decided to roll out Cyber Monday. They're going to have, you know, I don't know what, Throw Up Thursday.
Buy more crap Friday. You need a self-storage unit Sunday.
I mean, the taco industry got their own day.
Right, Taco Tuesday.
That's huge. That's the one I can relate. That one's fine.
We need more days of the week just so that we can, you know, offer them up to different brands.
Dude, you could have Sandwich Saturday. Oh, I don't know.
Look at you. You're like a marketer.
Yeah, but that whole thing. I mean, here asks the Jew. How did that happen? How did this Christmas thing happen where it's like suddenly you have to buy a whole bunch of shit to show people that, one, apparently you love Jesus Christ and you love your family?
Like, yes. I'm sure there's we could do a whole episode on how Christmas was commercialized, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But it's like this, right?
Oh, it's completely embedded. Yeah. And so many stores now, like, you get guilted into buying something because, like, you know, the local stores really rely on the Christmas season to stay in business.
Yeah.
So if you don't want your whole downtown shuttered, shop locally so you can, you know. I have a big problem is I have drawers that I open and I go, oh yeah, this is the kitsch that was in my stocking for the last 20 years. Like, the stuff doesn't go away, right?
All your little Beavis and Butthead dolls.
Little keychain knives or whatever that you can't actually use, because if you ever go someplace that has a metal detector, you lose your car keys. And I don't know. They're just crazy stuff, right? Where, what are you going to do with all this stuff? And so this is a
storage. We've already solved this problem.
Even if you are good and do your best,
you get gifts from people.
You get gifts from people that, like, yeah, right. It's like, how many pairs of pajamas do you need? I don't know. Or robes. So anyway,
I can't get enough.
That's why, again, you need your home incinerator from Amazon.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
So we started today with my therapy session on having worked at Toys R Us.
Uh-huh.
One escape route that happened to me is I got a job in landscaping. Okay,
yeah, mowing lawns and using leaf blowers.
Well,
sounds wonderful.
Yeah, but I'm here to tell you. Well, let's add to that. It was 100 degrees often in the southern United States.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty rough stuff. It was way, and I mean way more fulfilling.
Were you like listening to Toys R Us jingles you're doing
this
work?
Of course I was. But no, I mean, I can't say the work was unbelievably meaningful,
right.
But it was much more meaningful. And I was at least outside. I wasn't surrounded by, Technicolor plastic shit all day long.
And those Atlanta glass office parks looked wonderful because of you.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It was really, really quite nice. So, I mean...
Yeah.
To me, that's a first. Do the opposite. Is just avoid if you can.
Retail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I complained about, getting gifts and stuff. My wife actually has a nice set of rules for this. Like, there's an exception if
has a structure.
She does. She does. And her structure is if you're gift giving, give an experience.
Oh.
Right? She's trying to get me to do these wingsuit sort of courses.
What?
she's trying to kill
she
you.
She wants to kill you.
Well, there's good insurance right now,
yeah,
but
so
it's going to expire soon. So it's term.
Yeah, she's got to get you out there.
Yeah.
Also, because you're anti-consumerist, you're getting like a third-hand wingsuit.
Yeah.
Reused one. You don't know where it came from.
Yeah,
you don't know what happened to the guy.
This one's still good.
Who used it before you.
The left wing's got some holes in it.
Yeah.
But you can duct tape those.
Those are not blood marks on there.
No. Right. The other rules, it's like it's got to be edible, drinkable, or burnable, like candles or a cord of wood.
I was going to say everything's burnable, right?
Yeah.
You just need some gasoline.
Yeah.
A cord of wood as a gift.
Yeah.
Here's a few more infrastructure changes that I would want to see. I mean, one would be a complete boycott of the storage industry, maybe except when you're moving or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Another would be getting rid of or downplaying, to the extent you can, advertising.
Yeah.
And I got this pretty cool ad blocker software.
Mm-hmm.
We have to use computers for this godforsaken work that we're doing here.
Yeah.
And I notice the ad blocker works really well. Like, Asher, you're always sending depressing articles that I need to, maybe
it blocks the entire article.
Well, it will. It'll say like, oh, sorry, you... have to turn off your ad blocker to access this news website because that's how they're making their money. And it just saves me time because I don't read your article.
It's time and psyche, right?
Yeah.
A friend of ours, Steve Lambert, who's an artist, years and years ago, he developed like this Firefox add-on, which was basically an ad blocker, but what it did was replace ads with beautiful art.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is really sweet. Lovely.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like what you were saying, Jason, about the Costa Rica, small hut or whatever. Like, I like to think of infrastructure that a backpacker or a bike tourist has.
Jack Reacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really is like down to the essentials and the simplification that comes with it. I mean, I think that's why so many people like backpacking.
Right.
Well, I have a confession. So talk about essentials. I was backpacking. I was in Europe for 7 months and when I was in college in the early 90s. And at the time I was listening to the Grateful Dead on cassette tapes.
Nice.
And I was going to be gone for 7 months.
Wow. How many cassette tapes?
So I brought 60 cassette tapes. And that's set.
That's for one like, concert.
Right. That's not like a brick at the bottom of my huge backpack. That was like at least 10 pounds. That's and I had ridiculous. To take that with me. So, you know, your essentials and my essentials, right. Rob, might be a little different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, you're going to not have underwear, but you're going to have Grateful Dead
exactly.
Tapes.
Well, you know, I think we should call back to Vicki Robbins, Your Money or Your Life.
Yeah.
Because she talks about the meaningfulness of time. And this also then relates to the meaningfulness of stuff. If you think about if you're spending your time working, right, and you're making money, you have to work more to get all this stuff, to maintain all this stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if you can focus on the meaningfulness of stuff and pare it down, then your finances really become less of a critical thing. Like that can be secondary in your life rather than the primary thing you need so that you can have this stuff.
Yeah, it's huge. I feel like that's how I won't say got ahead, but caught up after I left college. I was in debt and I just didn't buy anything for 3 years. You know? And I remember it as a really happy time.
Yeah,
paid off all my student loans and it gave me the freedom to change careers because I didn't like what I was doing.
There's two things about that, that to me feel really important. One is, I mean, you were talking about the need to, in order to get this stuff, the need to get a, you know, a job and the pressure that creates. It's also the reverse in a sense, which is that I think that a lot of people resort to consumption of things, you know, whether it's products or it could be actually entertainment as a form of consumption, because they feel an emptiness in their lives, right? So if you're spending all your time working or doing things that are unfulfilling to you that don't feel that meaningful to you, you're actually more inclined to seek that that from something else. So if you're lucky enough to be able to dedicate your time to something that gives you joy and meaning and purpose, maybe there's a less of a desire to have, you know, consume things in order to kind of.
And you'll be paid so much less anyway that you won't have the possibility. Right, exactly.
That's,
It's a
beautiful virtuous circle. Yeah. You don't get paid shit. So you can't afford any of that. So, but the other piece about that was the second thing, which is that you can appreciate things a lot more when you don't have as much of them. You know, like if you're needing to save up for something or you decide that you're going to save up to get something that maybe is more expensive, but higher quality is going to last longer. It means a lot more to you, I think, than something you could buy quickly. And I think that's part of why, you know, the shit we get is so crappy. No wonder we just return 60% of it, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. One of the problems with trying to change the structure that surrounds us is it just, a lot of it's embedded in the laws or in the institutions, and we don't have direct access. So one of the things I often do is I make my own rule and pretend like it is one of those embedded rules. So the example is credit cards.
Yeah.
I've never carried a debt on a credit card my whole life.
Yeah, I haven't either. I mean, accidentally maybe. I forgot to pay it off. But
treat it like it's a debit card. Like you never buy stuff on a credit card unless you can stick it to the bank by just using the service but never paying them interest.
Yeah.
To me, that's a way to have your own policies. I want to turn to the cultural, like how can we have a different culture around consumerism? And this can be relatively quick because we covered this back in episode 33 when I got to interview Sandra Goldmark. Do you guys remember she had that book Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet? And so that was during our Hidden Drivers season, and it was an episode about relative status and status-seeking behavior, sort of the keeping up with the Joneses or the Kardashians. And she had these rules for stuff that I thought were pretty awesome.
We probably made that Kardashian joke in that episode.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, Jeez Louise. Too easy.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so she adapted these rules from Michael Pollan's rules. Pollan.
Yeah.
You say...
I don't know.
Tamolin. I say Tamolin. his rules for food were eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Very succinct, very nice. Yeah. What Sandra said about stuff, she said, have good stuff, not too much, mostly reclaimed. And you know, and then she added a coda which said, care for it and pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think pretty succinct, pretty awesome way. So if we could get that more widely dispersed in the culture, we'd be seeing some change.
And, you know, I think that we've been kind of down on the media a bit in this episode about how it propagates these sort of consumerist ideals. But there's also subversive elements in the media, you know, sometimes a popular movie. But I want to turn to music. Like, can you guys think of some music that is actually in songs that is anti-consumer?
Oh,
escaping consumer.
Totally, totally. I had a Cheryl Croissant recently.
Croissant.
Yeah, is that
she's outstanding performer.
Yeah, I actually saw her in concert once. It was really good. Anyway, she has that song Soak Up the Sun, right? Mm. Where my favorite lyric in that is
Soak Up the Sun.
My favorite lyric is it's not having what you want, it's wanting what you've got.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Okay, can you guys figure out which the song is? All right, ready? What's the matter with the clothes I'm wearing? Can't you tell that your tie's too wide?
Yeah, that's the Billy Joel song.
Maybe I should buy some old tab collars. Welcome back to the age of jive.
You stop. Okay.
It's a good one. It's
still rock and roll to me.
Yeah. Everybody's talking about the new sound funny, but it's still rock and roll to me.
All right.
It's a great song. I love Billy Joel. Now, here's the deal.
Hmm.
That song was a consequence of Billy Joel getting pressure from like the music industry.
Didn't he record a song called Pressure too?
Yeah, he did.
Okay. But they were pressuring him, this is 1980, to like get into the new wave, get into something a little more
synthesizy
and stuff like that. And he's just like, you know, no. Like this fashion-y, gimmicky, fatty stuff. It's not about that.
Let me share one more song, because we got to have something that's from modern history here in this. Can't all be Grateful Dead and Billy Joel and even Sheryl Crow.
Yeah.
So there was this song that came out, I think in 2022, by a performer named Jax called Victoria's Secret. And the lyrics in there, she says...
She sings. Why don't you sing it?
I don't know the tune very well. Okay. And I'm not going to perform live like you just did. She says, I know Victoria's Secret, girl you wouldn't believe. She's an old man who lives in Ohio making money off of girls like me.
Mm-hmm.
Cashing in on body issues, selling skin and bones with big boobs. I know Victoria's Secret, she was made up by a dude.
That's good, man.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's a really good song, and it's kind of about, don't fall prey to the deception. Who gives a shit about the Joneses?
Well, and that's the thing is when you peel back the curtain on it a little bit, you just see
like
that it's all manipulation, right? And you've got, these companies that are basically selling products to fill an emptiness that's in our hearts and basically co-opting people that we look up to who maybe were creative and wonderful at one point or whatever and then became sellouts. Here I am being super cynical about this, but...
Well, wait till you hear we have as a sponsor today. Wait till the end to hear that one.
Right.
Okay. So, is anybody doing this? Like, can we give some? We're saying here we should maybe do this kind of stuff. Where can we turn to for inspiration? There's this Swedish concept called lagom, which sort of means
lagom,
which sort of means just the right amount. You know, enoughness.
Mm.
Right? Is that a word? Enoughness?
Sure. And let me just
You're asking the right guy.
Yeah,
enough
exactly.
is enough.
Yeah. Great book. Buy it.
Yeah.
Give it a Christmas.
I should put out a Swedish version. Yeah. Lagom is lagom.
Yeah.
But can I just say I'm proud of you, Asher, for attempting a Swedish accent without doing it Muppet-style Swedish chef.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's less offensive. Way to go.
Oh, it's probably still offensive to our Swedish listeners.
Yeah. And it's sort of, there's this social cohesion that happens when like, you don't take too much. You're happy and just have enough. So there's always then a fair share. It's also about thinking about others, not just about yourself.
Well, does it tie to what you were just talking about, a share with the idea of there's an emptiness?
Yeah.
And so instead of shopping or having an instant dopamine hit that goes away also instantly. That if you can think about how much is enough and be satisfied with that, you're just so much more secure and so much less susceptible to that emptiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's true.
Were there any ABBA songs about that?
I don't know. My God, there's got to be a modern popular Swedish artist. We'd have to go back to ABBA.
They had a great Abbott tribute band at the Benton County Fair. Anyway.
You know, there's crossover, actually, when you think about sort of indigenous views on enoughness, right? I'm going to quote an article that was back from 2009, but it pretty much says the same kind of idea of what you're talking about. And I'm quoting here. An indigenous system is based on prosperity, creation, kinship, and a sense of enoughness. It is designed for sharing. Potlatches, giveaways, these involve deliberately accumulating wealth as a person or as a family or as a clan for the sole purpose of giving it away. That puts in motion a continual ongoing requirement for redistribution. Hmm. So it's kind of like flipping it on its head a little bit. And it just reminds me, I want to give a plug for another podcast that we've produced called Holding the Fire, which is interviews with indigenous thought leaders from around the world, where they talk a lot about the cultures that they come from.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something for us to learn from and take in for sure.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. And even just kind of putting it into practice a little bit where I live is the whole idea of sharing with your neighbors and being able to give away, like when I have something that I don't need or I have extra produce that I've grown or whatever, like that kind of stuff happens a lot.
Yeah.
And I think our culture, unfortunately, has sort of like shied away from that in a sense, but I've gone the other direction. Like I am completely okay with asking anybody in my neighborhood for anything of theirs.
That's great. And cup of sugar.
Maybe
of
they think I'm, something's wrong with me or something. But I'm like, do you have a miter saw that I could use? Yeah. Can I use your lawnmower? Like, I don't want to buy all this crap and I don't need it for much.
That's good.
That's the other thing is we were talking about dopamine earlier, the dopamine you get from buying something or unpacking something that I would say the dopamine of giving something, of lending something, it's got to be at least as high.
It's a true dopamine hit.
Yeah. This is going to be like such a trope. But another thing to keep in mind is just the three R's, right, of reduce, reuse, recycle as a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know we've heard it ad nauseum, but, you know, it's there for a reason. And I think it's a pretty sound, you talked about rules earlier. I think it's a pretty sound one as well. And, you know, and then buy stuff to last. I mean, I talked about that a little bit earlier, you know, buying things that are made out of quality, buying things that you can actually repair. There are efforts underway now to push back against the fact that most of the things you buy now, you cannot repair them.
Right.
You can't disassemble them or whatever. And there is starting to be a pushback against that. Learn how to sew yourself. You know, you got to get, you know, I know that you're looking for a pair of crotchless panties for yourself, Jason.
Yeah.
Sew your own.
Why? Okay.
Why?
I didn't ask why.
No, okay. Not why is he. Why do you have to bring this up?
Just a great example.
It's Come imagery on. No one needs.
Real world example.
No one needs it. Yeah.
Well, look, at the societal scale, besides, you know, sort of in your own household, I think there are things that we can support as well. In looking for some ideas for this episode, I came across a book by Wendy Wollison. She's a professor historian, and she wrote a book called Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America.
Nice.
Yeah. And she had this, I listened to her on a podcast, and she had this pretty cool summary of how things used to work with clothing. And she said, historically, clothing would be refashioned over time. So I have an outfit and it would get worn. So the first thing you do is you would re-dye it, get the color back up to snuff, and you would re-sew it if there's anything that needs that. And then over time, that would get kind of worn out. And so then what they would do is they would take it apart. You would take the stitching out and you would re-sew an article of clothing for a smaller person out of it. And then when that got worn out, there were people who were rag dealers that would come around, and you would sell this used piece of clothing to a rag dealer who would then get it converted into paper or another usable thing.
Yeah.
Now, we might not be able to get back to that.
No, but I think, you know, there is that the Patagonia kind of movement, right? Where they,
yeah,
they're actually selling their own clothes that has been worn before, the worn wear program. And they do some repair and they do a lot of recycling. If it really is worn out, they'll try to recycle it into something new. So so that's core, you know, upcycling is the other term you sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, Patagonia, I think, has been known for a long time as being at sort of the vanguard of efforts to rethink what a corporation kind of does, right?
Yeah.
You think about a company that's selling apparel,
right,
products, changing the entire business model. There need to be more of them. Interface is the carpet company,
right,
is another one that people have talked about. We need a lot more of them, obviously, to do that. But it's great to have those examples from the corporate world. I think it's worth talking about what people are doing on a policy level as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And got to go to the most brilliant country on earth, the French.
Really?
You certainly can't stay in America for good policies on consumerism.
So a couple of things. In 2016, they passed a law in France that forced supermarkets to donate expired food. Hmm. We could have a whole conversation about wasted food, right? As long as there wasn't a safety risk,
right,
with that food. And 3 years later, it appeared to be working. Donations to food banks are up 20%. In 2020, they passed an anti-waste law for a circular economy.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's early days yet, but some of the key things that were put into that law was no destroying unsold or returned items. Right.
Jeez.
And we've talked about that
with
the fashion industry, right?
Yeah.
All plastic needs to be recyclable by 2025.
Gee, that's coming up.
50% reduction in single-use plastic bottles, phasing out of paper receipts. Fast food takeout restaurants have to stop using plastic containers, I guess, by last year.
Whoa.
I don't know how they did. Informing consumers about repairability of their products, what we talked about earlier. Helping them make decisions about longevity, environmental impacts of their products. So, you know, really trying to push on kind of
incroyable
incentives and regulatory structures, you know, to shift that.
Well,
très bien.
If there's one thing that Americans like, it's the French.
Yes, and to learn from the French.
May we be in
the French example.
Yeah. Oui, excellent.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard and you want others to consider these issues, then please share Crazy Town with your friends. Hit that share button in your podcast app or just tell them face to face. Maybe you can start some much needed conversations and do some things together to get us out of Crazy Town. Thanks again for listening and sharing.
Discerning consumers have been long and hard overlooked by the adult pleasure industry, which is laden with cheap consumer products that are toxic, disposable, and produced in ways that harm workers. Not at all the kinds of kitsch you want touching your body's most sensual places, where delicate membranes and lubricating fluids abound. But finally, those of us who care about our bodies and the earth can revel in the sensuous selections created by the sultry Swedish sex designer, Inga Muftgussen. Whether it's the luxurious alpaca hair crochet cod pieces, the anal beads made from recycled IKEA light bulbs, or the fishnet stockings made out of actual fishnets recovered from the Pacific Gyre, your pleasure is our business. Better yet, this month, Inga's Bedroom is offering first-time customers 10% off their line of lubricants from the reclaimed fry oil of Carl's Jr. and Long John Silver's restaurants. Inga's Bedroom, where sex has never been more sustainable.
Crazy Town, da 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 da, Crazy Town.